Coming up on this week's show, how to emulate Nintendo's biggest failure.
The return of physical media.
And we chat to YouTube and indie game legend, John Riggs.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one of their books I highly recommend, Neo Geo, A Visual History. Now, if like me, you used to drool over the Neo Geo when you were a kid, from Art of Fighting to World Heroes, Samurai Showdown, Metal Slug, SNK's classic games are all here and presented in gorgeous detail. You can check that out, Neo Geo, A Visual History, and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our lovely friends at PCBWay. Now, if you're working on anything retro at the moment, they offer a fully featured custom PCB prototyping service. You know, they do low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and they offer services like 3D printing, injection molding, and lots more. And of course, you'll know that PCBWay are massive supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote right now on their website at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 418, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the podcast. Of course, the show that every single Friday takes you on a nostalgic trip back to the golden age of video games, exploring old consoles, classic computers, arcades, and of course, bringing it up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro from over the last 7 days, along with a veteran of the industry on the podcast for a bit of a chat in the second half of the show. And here we are, over 8 years of doing this podcast now, and it just feels like, you know, it does feel like it's just got to a stage where there is actually more and more news to talk about every single week, particularly in the realm of indie development at the moment. You know, we've talked about this quite a bit over the last couple of weeks. You're actually at an Indie Games Award in Nottingham a couple of weeks ago, Ravi. And that was where you were hanging out with this week's special guest, who I'm sure many of our audience will be familiar with because he's a very famous YouTuber. This is Mr. John Riggs, who's going to be joining us this week.
Yeah, I think the whole indie game scene at the moment is really amazing. I love some of the titles that have come out. And, you know, this whole scene didn't exist years ago.
Yeah.
Now it's become something solid, but also a lot of the kind of retro titles are getting put in there, new concepts, new ideas, and it's like a kind of platform or a playground for them to shine in.
You know, it's mad to think, because I do remember that era in the 90s when we got to around, you know, 95, 96, when, like, you know, the Amiga was fading away. Obviously, it had stuff like the Net Eurosi on the PS1, but really it felt like for a time in the late 90s to early 2000s, when, like, the homebrew scene didn't really exist like it does now, you know, before we all had the internet, it felt like the games industry was a bit inaccessible to those, yeah, you know, what were formerly kind of bedroom coders. There wasn't really that era around that.
Well, trends come in and completely destroy and take over stuff. You know, there was that huge thing to go 3D. Everything had to go 3D. Every single title had 3D. And then there's been VR recently, you know, and I think it's AI at the moment, but
yeah,
these kind of trends come around and a lot of really good stuff gets forgotten about or isn't that popular and kind of gets pushed away. So it's great that they're getting highlighted now.
Well, last week on the show, of course, we were chatting to Ali Mottisi, who leads the Out of the Bit studio, and of course they're doing incredible indie games. And this week, kind of a bit of a follow-on, exploring some more indie games as well. And we're going to be talking about YouTube too with John Riggs, because he's got a really interesting career. And Joe and I did this interview, and I do say this to John in the interview, I've got no idea when he sleeps.
Yeah, because he's a radio DJ and journalist by day.
Yeah.
And then his YouTube channel, he pretty much puts out a video. I mean, this month he's put out, I think it's the 27th of February and the day of recording, and he's put 24 videos out this month already.
Probably every weekday then.
Entire channel.
Yeah. Ravi's been on YouTube for 15 years. He's not done that.
But as well as that, he's also put out a book about cereal. And then obviously one of the biggest things we speak about in this interview is his indie game development and his involvement in the indie scene, as well as homebrewing. And on top of that, He's a father, so I don't know when he sleeps.
Now, Joe, you speaking as a dad, I know how tired you are when you get home from work and you've got to get the kids to bed and stuff.
I struggle with, you know, just full-time work and then this on the side, which, you know, for me, you know, it is only a couple of hours, you know, two nights a week, really, you know, 3-4 hours, kind of two nights a week. And that's it. That's all my time gone, you know, other than kind of hanging out with my daughter. So, yeah, hats off to John, man, and his passion. Really, really comes across in the interview. You know, he's so enthusiastic and positive about everything, you know, and about everything he works on and everything in that scene as well and everything in the retro community. Really, really big personality. And yeah, really loved this interview. And it was nice to be back on one because of, I've not been on one in a while with us posting out the book and stuff like that.
We just so put I'm Joe in a room.
Yeah, and, like, I'm back
forced
in.
Him to
come out when you're good.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was great to have you on this one as well, because I know you've been a big fan of John on YouTube for many years now, haven't you? You started watching him when he was on Metal Jesus's channel, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he was originally, you know, he was friends with Jason, Metal Jesus, and, you know, he invited him on his channel and, you know, John did a few shows with him and then, you know, it kind of grew from there. So, yeah, really cool to catch up with him and have a chat with him. And he listens to the show as well, which was fantastic.
Yeah,
so nice thanks for coming on, John.
Yeah, so really interesting chat. We cover so much in about an hour with John. So everything from, like you said, his YouTube channel, his community contributions, his love for retro breakfast cereals as well, making games on the NES and the Dreamcast, all of that coming up with our special guest, John Riggs. He's on the show in around half an hour from now. Now, of course, we are into March. Doesn't feel like it's getting any warmer here in the UK, though. A little glimmer of sunshine today, but I think it's still around minus one this afternoon.
I think last week, like, I don't know if people noticed, but we were all ill.
Yeah.
And I think Dan lost hearing in one ear.
Very bizarre editing a podcast with one ear. Yeah. I've got to say.
You did a good job.
Yeah, so apologies if there's any misses.
But the weather's been really hitting us.
Yes, I mean, we are looking forward to getting into some warmer months and, of course, events and all that coming up again. We'll keep you posted on all of that. But it has been a very busy week in retro over the last 7 days. Now, we'll start with a story that I know you guys were big Pokemon fans back in the day. I've got to admit, the Pokemon kind of craze passed me by, but I know it was absolutely massive. And this, I imagine, would have been a story that would have excited you greatly as a kid, Joe. This is actually a way to create and trade Pokemons using a bit of a hack.
Well, interestingly, you just said this would have got me excited as a child, but it's really funny that we've seen this. My friend, my good friend Ali, this week has actually just bought 2 copies of Pokemon and 2 Game Boys off me.
Right.
So he can trade Pokemon to himself. So he's literally sat there at home with Game Boy Advance and a Game Boy Color, trading from Pokemon Red and Blue onto Pokemon Yellow so he can get all original 100.
How does that work then? Pokemon. Explain how that works for people like me that haven't played it.
So you originally got, well, in the UK, it's a bit different in Japan because you got Pokemon Red, Blue and Green. But in the UK, you got Pokemon Red and Blue. Red had so many Pokemon on it and Blue had so many Pokemon on it. And in total, there was 151. But there was like 50, which was on both. And then like, you know, kind of like 30 or so, which was exclusive to Blue. And then 30 or so was exclusive to Red.
Mm.
And then there was 3 starter Pokemon. So obviously when you start your game, if you pick Squirtle, Charmander or Bulbasaur, that is your starter Pokemon. You can't catch them in the game. So that creates the situation where if you want all 151 Pokemon, you have to trade Pokemon with other people between the games. That was being an RPG, the concept.
Some people preferred kind of playing a certain Pokemon as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, other people would capture them and someone would then trade with them because, you know, I was a Red and Blue guy.
Yeah.
But I know other people like Silver and all of those kind of
things. Yeah, exactly. But the bottom line was with the original Pokemon games, when they first came out, there was 151. You couldn't get all of them on one cartridge. You had to trade with friends from the other versions of Pokemon. That was the bottom line.
And did it delete them from theirs? Did it like kind of swap?
Yeah, yeah, no, it was a trade. Right. It was a full-on trade. It wasn't like a copy and paste. Like, you know, if Ravi had a copy of Blue and I had a copy of Red, I traded him my Charmander, that would be gone. It was gone off my cartridge, but you'd have to trade it for one of his Pokemon. So the idea is you would trade exclusives with each other, so a Pokemon that's exclusive to one version of the game to another, if that makes sense.
Interesting.
And it's still, that's still how you do it to this day. You
You've
know,
got to collect them all, Dan.
You've got to collect them all, Dan. Yeah.
Well, that's how you do it until today, because there is now a bit of a cheeky method, a bit of a cheat, a way around this, using something called the Flipper Zero, which Ravi seemed very clued up about when we started talking about this before we started recording.
It's a very, very naughty device that is also being used in the retro gaming world to do good things. So, you know, Flipper Zeros, it's like when you watched a film when you were a kid in the 90s and someone would get out a computer and go, I'm going to hack this, I'm going to hack that. The Flipper Zero's like a transceiver. So, you know, it's got infrared on there. It's got an NFC reader. You can do all sorts of stuff, turn it into a universal remote control. You can do a opening garden gates, garages, even worse stuff like that as well, that we won't go into on this podcast. But it's a very powerful device and it seems very small and cute. A lot of people have used it as like a little mischief device, you know, to do stuff. But now it's started to get a reputation as a bit of a retro gaming add-on device as well. Raspberry Pi actually released a video game module for the Flipper Zero. So this is a little module that you stick on the top of this little handheld device, the Flipper, and you can then connect it to your television. You can also add in a controller port as well, so you can have like a joystick or you know, a game controller, and then you can use the gyroscope inside as well to turn it into a motion controller as well. So people have started playing with this device and adding extra stuff. They've now added the ability to trade Pokemon on there, which is really cool because they did Amiibos previously, because, you know, the Amiibo is like an NFC.
Yeah.
So you could scan the Amiibo, take the digital code off the Amiibo, have it on your Flipper, and then use the Flipper and store all your Amiibos on there, which is really cool. But this is a kind of older generation now, because they've actually got the Game Boy cable adapted it, and it is going into the Flipper.
Yeah, so the Flipper, for people who haven't seen it, it's a small device. I'd say probably around maybe half the... You remember the old Nokia phones, the kind of little candy stick phones? The size of one of them, it looks like, doesn't it? Got a little, little D-pad on there, a screen with a cute little dolphin who pops up, I imagine named after Flipper, the famous dolphin.
It's a very naughty dolphin, yeah.
It seems like it from what this device can do. But yeah, I mean, they're essentially linking it to, in this series of images here, into a Game Boy Color using a link cable. And then you get a little selector on the Flipper Zero where you can go through and pick which Pokemon you want to trade over to your Game Boy from the full selection.
You know, I think this could expand. So, like, the Flipper is the ultimate reader and writer, basically. You know, you're able to do it with NFC. You're able to do it with everything. I can see people starting to get adapters for different carts, for different systems that have been offline, and then kind of, you know, creating little devices for it and expanding the retro gaming world.
And I'm wondering if, because I'm imagining, you know, Joe does all these retro gaming markets. I'm imagining Joe there with like one of these, like, who do you want on your Game Boy then? Come on, like, dodgy Mac on. Put this cable
in. Blastoise for a quid.
Exactly, yeah.
Honestly, I could see it becoming like an EverDrive in a way. Attached to a Game Boy cart or something, and then you just blast the image onto it or read another cart.
Yeah,
or maybe there and you know, recreate it straight away.
Or even like an Action Replay or a, you know, Game Shark, something like that, I imagine.
Yeah,
could use for this.
So, yeah, you could use it to modify the games, I guess.
Yeah, so a lot of power packed into a small little device, and great to see it being used for retro uses already. So if you want to check that out and how it works, I will link up that article in the show notes along with everything else we talk about. You see the Money Podcast app or head to the website at theretrohour.com. Now, in modern gaming news, I've been seeing it everywhere this week, that apparently Microsoft are going to be announcing a new Xbox at some point this summer. Big rumour is that it will not have an optical drive on there. We heard about the abandonment of physical media by Game, our main game shop. You know, they're moving out of trade-ins, and they're doing, when you walk in there now, it's a lot of these kind of just coupon codes, isn't it, or game cards that you get on the shelf. Everyone's saying physical media is dead, but this could be a reversal of its fortunes. This is a new disc, apparently in the form of a typical DVD or a Blu-ray or a CD, that can apparently hold 200 terabytes of information, or that is 1.6 petabytes, if you like. So that's around 2,000 PS5 games.
I mean, just to reflect on what you said there about the death of the physical media thing, it feels very much that that's like, you know, the big companies that are trying to do that, and that,
yeah,
you know, us as the consumers, some of us, well, a lot of us are still quite happy with physical media, because eBay actually released earlier this week that physical media, so video games, DVDs, etc., was the third best-selling thing for 2023 last year.
Right.
Yeah. So there's still obviously a big market for it.
I've heard there's been a reversal, yeah, of that, because a lot of people are kind of getting a bit fed up of, you know, streaming platforms, the price is increasing, and the availability, you know, you might be halfway through watching a series and it vanishes. There's also, you know, stuff like some companies have been editing their old TV series and taking bits out that they reckon might be offensive now that some of the original fans wanted in its original form. So I can see that there is definitely a market for people who want to own it. And it's weird though, because I was on Threads today, first time I've gone on Threads for quite a while. And the first thing I saw on there is, you know, this this post about the Xbox losing its optical drive. And a lot of the comments of people were like, oh, I've been fully digital since like 2015. I'm not bothered. And then someone did comment going, yeah, that's all well and good, as long as you realize that you're only renting the games for a limited amount of time. And if the game companies are doing that, surely that should reflect in its price. You know, you can't be charging 65 quid for something they might take offline in 5 years. That doesn't feel fair.
It's interesting that this is in disc format, because, yeah, you know, lots, well, quite a few servers are using LTO tapes, which, you know, they're basically tape capacity, but they can take a huge amount of data as well. I think this is interesting that it's going to become a disc, because a disc you can print, you can get out there fast.
And they're cheap.
Yeah, it's random access as well, where I guess a tape, you know, you've got physical tape, you've got to get through it. And I think this sounds interesting. I don't know if I'd ever be able to feel that, though.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, this is scientists at the University of Shanghai for Science and Technology. They've created this, they call it an ultra-capacity optical disc, apparently using 3D recording techniques. So you can fit 1.6 petabytes on there, which is, I think a Blu-ray is around 128 gigabytes.
Yeah, LTO tape with compressed is 1.4 petabytes.
Yeah, well, they're saying this medium here, it looks like they're really aiming this at Enterprise as a backup solution. They're saying that actually it uses a blue laser, very similar to today's Blu-ray, but there's a specialized lens system that focuses on these really thin layers, and they kind of stack the disc, not like you've got like multi-layer DVDs.
Yeah.
It kind of works a bit like that. And they reckon that the media will last around, or at least 10 years. Now, I've got some CDRs that I burnt like 25 years ago, you know, when I first got a CD burner, that are still readable today.
You must have been buying the nice CDRs. I had the ones from Asda. They lasted about one year.
I've got some that have got bit rot and everything, but there are some that have still survived. I think, you know, in terms of, it seems more reliable than magnetic media at least. But the thing about this is they've got this prototype at the moment. They're saying that it handles around 100 megabits a second, which is obviously a lot slower than a hard disk, but faster than tape backup.
Yeah, I think this tape stuff as well is really far off, where I don't know, you know, that they're using it at the moment, but it's like 36 terabytes, you know, to get to the petabytes is going to be take a real long time. But I also think it's probably going to save in money, probably saving the environment as well, if you get this stuff done, without using up so much resources.
Well, they're saying that there may even be a way to make it work with existing Blu-ray drives.
That's
which
bonkers.
I think that could be a game changer. And they're saying, but the problem is, there does seem to be this trend away from optical media. So they're saying, depending on whether adoption or whether they get any more money, you know, enough money to kind of finish it, whether or not that kind of happens means, you know, whether or not it's going to hit the market in the next 5 years if the development goes ahead. But I'm thinking, though, I mean, could this reverse, like, you know, the PlayStation and the Xbox's idea of abandoning physical media? Because if you can fit, you know, all that amount of game, you know, if you fit like 2,000 PS5 games on a disc that they can press for about 80 pence, and it might even work with the existing PS5 optical drive, surely you've got to be looking at that and thinking, hang on a minute, maybe we shouldn't, we should reconsider our position on optical media.
I just get a dirty feeling about so much storage. It's weird because we come from the days where you have like a 30 megabyte hard disk and you'd really work hard to try and make it, you know, kind of fit everything and optimized. And when it gets to these levels, I just feel like, oh, that's such a waste. You know, what I could do with that if I had the time.
I remember a kid at school talking about a gigabyte and I was like, what the hell is that? That doesn't exist.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, it's like infinite amount of storage. But it's weird though, because like in my Amiga 4000 now, I've got 180 gigabyte hard disk and then it's nearly full.
Yeah, I could
quite
just
how much you fill out on an Amiga. I think if you've got the space, you find a way to fill it.
Having a few of these as a NAS drive or something, and you've got everything on there, you know.
Yeah, I'm hoping this does come to market, because I think I've got a feeling that the main game platforms will not adopt this as a game medium. But I think that is where it excites me, the fact that you can basically archive everything you've got onto a single one of these discs.
Yeah, archive.org would probably fit one.
Yeah, so that is incredible. So hopefully that will go ahead, and if it does, that's going to be on the market, I reckon, in the next 5 years, if they can get the funding and get enough people testing it out and behind it. So fingers crossed. We'll read more about that. I will put that in the show notes as well. Now, a system that I bet none of us have got in our collections. Have you ever played one? The Nintendo Virtual Boy? You must have played one before, Joe.
I don't think I have. You know? No, I don't think I have.
I've played one before at like a game show, but my neck hurt because the position of it was so bad.
No, I don't think I've ever played one. I think I've seen them in person, you know, at game shows and markets and stuff for sale. But no, definitely don't have one. Way, way, way too expensive to just sit on the shelf and not be played.
Well, it was definitely Nintendo's biggest failure in their history, as far as I can remember. I've got a feeling there's about 20, 22 games were released on that.
Yeah, not a lot.
Sales were really poor. I think it was on sale in Japan for around 6 months before it got yanked off the market. And I must admit, I haven't explored the Virtual Boy's library all that much. Obviously, it's a bit of a laughing stock when you mention it to anyone, you know, kind of in the same breath as like the CDI or the Jaguar. It's a bit like, oh, a fell system. But looking at today, I was checking out a few videos of Virtual Boy aficionados. You know, there are a few on YouTube who make videos about the small collection. And there are a few on there that look pretty decent. Mario's Tennis, which was the launch title on the Virtual Boy, featured characters from the Mario franchise. Because it had a 3D effect, didn't it? Now, if you haven't played the Virtual Boy before, that was the thing about it. It wasn't really a virtual reality headset. It had a similar form factor, but you'd kind of crouch down, look into it. And then it was this weird kind of black and red colour in the games that made them into 3D, wasn't it?
It's just kind of depth. That's what it felt like,
Yeah, you're right there. A lot of the games, I think the Wario game and, like you say, the tennis game, Mario's Tennis, it was the depth perception of the game.
Yeah.
You know, everything had a kind of like, oh, there's a background and a foreground to the game, or kind of a wireframe in those red graphics, you know, pseudo 3D kind of like looking game. But yeah, considering the name Virtual Boy, it wasn't a virtual reality headset.
Which a lot of people mistakenly call it, don't they? Like, oh, it was Nintendo's VR headset, which obviously it wasn't. But obviously emulating that, if you want to get that 3D effect on like a standard PC, you're not going to get the full experience. But it turns out there is another bit of hardware that is cheaply available and easily hackable, that now there is a fully playable, full-speed Virtual Boy emulator on the Nintendo 3DS.
Yeah, this came out about 2 or 3 days ago, and it's called Red Viper, which I think is a really, really cool name. Mm. But yeah, it allows you to emulate Virtual Boy games on the top screen of the 3DS, and then the bottom screen is just a kind of like a menu, and the buttons are there as well. Seems to run really, really well, and kind of makes you forget from the little video I'm watching here that it is a Virtual Boy game. It just makes you look at it and just think it's a game.
Yeah, a wireframe kind of vector.
It's just a wireframe game. Yeah, like a little bit like Star Fox or kind of like a Vectrex maybe. You know, if you'd shown me this, I just would have thought, oh, okay, yeah, it's kind of like just a retro game. But I guess might be a much nicer way to play Virtual Boy games as well, if you really want to.
The big deal about doing it on the 3DS is, and it's hard to see in a video, but actually the 3D support does work.
Oh, does it? Oh, yeah. Wow.
So you can use, you know, you've got the little slider on the right of the screen on the 3DS. You can turn that up, and actually that 3D effect that you would have seen looking into the Virtual Boy goggles actually is displayed on the 3DS
screen. That's awesome, because it worked quite well on the 3DS.
Yeah, well, it's a perfect system for it. And you know, they're saying that all the licensed games are playable in full screen, even on the original 3DS. So, you know, there's a couple of models of the 3DS as well. There's even game saves are supported on here as well. You can remap the buttons to make it more comfortable. The C-stick is supported on the later 3DS. Configurable face button mapping. You can even change the colour filter to make it more comfortable to look at as well. And they've got big plans to develop this further as well, including, because there is a homebrew scene on the Virtual Boy, believe it or not. I can't think of any titles off the top of my head, but apparently there are a couple of them out there. So they're saying that the plan is to support, you know, all the homebrew games that are out there too, make the colour filters more versatile as well, support for PCM samples and, you know, better save states. And so it does seem like it's, because to me there's been so many of the mainstream systems have got, you know, a variety of emulators. And I must admit, the Virtual Boy is not anything I've actually sat down and played before, because again, I'd always feel like if I was looking at it on my computer's monitor, I'm not getting the effect that was intended, but it makes perfect sense that this would run on the 3DS.
It makes sense. I mean, I'm not huge on that. I like the 3DS as a, you know, the games on it and stuff, but the, you know, the gimmick of the 3D on it actually made me feel sick. Right. Gave me a headache.
I could play it, but I just couldn't put it too far, maybe around 25%. That would work for me. But yeah,
I just remember playing Nintendogs on it a lot.
Okay. 3D dogs coming out the screen. Yeah, so I mean, for me, it's not the novelty of the 3D and actually playing the Virtual Boy in 3D on it. It's more the novelty of, oh, that's an easier way to play Virtual Boy and emulate it, if that makes sense.
Are you interested in the Virtual Boy games then, having not experienced them before?
No, to be perfectly honest, it's never appealed to me and it's never been a system, not even the price point of it or anything like that. It's just never been a system that I've been like, oh, I need to get my hands on one of them. You know, I want that on the shelf or whatever. It's not even the fact that it costs like 500 quid or whatever it is now. It's just, I don't know. I think the gameplay just doesn't appeal to me, which is really interesting because I love the Game Boy.
Yeah.
And it's not like a million miles away from, you know, kind of the quality of Game Boy games.
Maybe just don't fancy throwing up your lunch after playing
it. Yeah, maybe it was just that. Maybe it was just that. But I think for me, I guess, interestingly, one of the simplest features of this is the fact that you can filter the colours. On the little video here, he changes it to a turquoisey green. And that does actually look so much nicer to look at.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of those old school kind of vector graphics games, you know, that you'd see on like those monitors back in the day, the green monitors, which I think looks cooler as well than the red effect. So that just gets a bit dark and it gets a bit lost in the black sometimes when I see it on videos. Yeah. But I've got a 3DS and I haven't modded it yet, but this is making me think that maybe I should, because this is just the first release of it. It is available on GitHub, so, you know, completely free. Anyone can download it. And it looks like the ROMs are available for the Virtual Boy games. You can find them pretty simple online. So I think this might be something that I have a go at the weekend. So I'll report back if unless I'm in like some kind of coma or, you know, vomiting my guts up on Monday morning. But yeah, so looks quite interesting. So a good way to play Virtual Boy games if it's been a system that you've been interested in, but, you know, want to actually experience that 3D effect without paying those extortionate eBay prices for an original unit. So I'll link that up in the show notes as well. Now, imagine Ravi is pretty excited about this next story. There can't be many games that over 25 years after their initial release is still getting updates and DLC, but it turns out Age of Empires 2 has just got some new content.
I'd say Joe loves it as well, from what I remember.
I am. I'm a big fan of Age of Empires 2. But so this is, am I right in thinking this is new DLC? Age of Empires 2, but it's for the HD version that came out in 2019.
Yeah, well, Definitive Edition.
The Definitive Edition, sorry.
Yeah, but also it's quite interesting because it's a mix of new content. So it's an expansion pack with like 19 scenarios, but 14 of them are based on user-created content.
Oh, okay.
So these kind of fans have created, you know, some fantastic stuff. Like, behind these games, there's always a good community and there's a good fan base that keep them going. I personally don't have enough time to play these games. And, like, I absolutely adore them. Maybe when I'm on holiday or something, I'll just really get into it. but, you know, strategy games, God, I could spend weeks on them. AOE and also, you know, Civilization as well. But these are 14 campaigns. Users have created the content, and then what they've done is they've cleaned them up a bit. They've added professional voice acting on there as well, tweaked it, and fixed up this user content, which I think is a really nice kind of way of approaching it. Thinking these are the fans, you know, we're going to add a few of our own scenarios in there, but we're going to use what's popular and clean it up.
And what I love about it as well is, like you say, these are, you know, scenarios which have been made by the fans, but they are still based or loosely based and focused on, you know, real life events, historical battles,
yeah,
and stuff like that, which, you know, was always like the point of Age of Empires. You know, there was always like, oh yeah, it's William Wallace story, or, and they've based a lot of this on Ragnar Lothbrok, who I don't actually know who that is, but I'm not a history buff at all.
I guess that's the Vikings and
yeah.
Norway and that kind of Nordic region. Definitely sounds like that. Yeah. No, it looks really cool. And is this something that you'd try out, Joe?
You know what? So it's only £9.99 or £12.99 in dollars. And the Age of Empires Definitive Edition is actually available on Xbox Game Pass. And I was really excited about this to a point where, like, I was looking up when it was going to come out on Game Pass because a friend at work told me it was coming out on Game Pass. And I was like, oh my God, I love Age of Empires 2. I love it. And I played it like twice, and it's because it was the controller. I really, really, really didn't get along
with
it.
Yeah, I couldn't play it with the controller at all. It's a definite mouse and keyboard game.
Yeah, and I was just like, oh, what is this kind of thing? And, you know, maybe I should revisit it on the Xbox because I haven't got time to play it on my PC.
Bluetooth a mouse and keyboard onto the Xbox? Maybe that'll work.
I think you can in some games, yeah.
I'll have to give it a try because, like, you know, I have got a Bluetooth mouse and keyboard, so that's not a bad idea. But funny enough, you should say this. My wife, right now, no word of a lie, is playing The Sims 4 on Xbox, and she's playing with the controller. And I said to her, because she's been playing that this week, and I said to her, like, is that not feel horrible? Does that not feel weird? And she's like, you get used to it after a few hours. So maybe I need to go back to it. But, you know, for $9.99 to expand the game by, you know, 14 levels, I think is a no-brainer if you're
yeah, it's actually 19, but then 14 user ones.
Yeah,
there you go. Are included in that.
My mistake.
Yeah, I just don't think I've got the attention span for those kind of games. So they're a big time sink, aren't they?
I love how totally. I've just said, I tried to play it on Xbox. Ravi says, I play on Mac. And Dan's just said, I ain't got the time for these games.
Yeah, and the brains, Joe. You nearly said it right.
We all need to get PC gaming rigs and just sit down.
I've got one. I just don't use
strategy
it.
Strategy LAN, yeah.
I've got one. I use it for watching YouTube and editing videos. But yeah, so if you are a fan of that, I mean, I know obviously it's a massive title and we've done episodes about Age of Vampires before. I know you guys were huge fans back in the day. So it's great to see that, admittedly, the remastered version is getting some DLC over 25 years after the original game came out. So if you want to get hold of that, I'll link up the article in the show notes as well. Now, there's one more story before we hop into our chat with the incredible John Riggs in just a moment. Now, I just feel like this has almost become a bit of a meme in the retro podcast sphere over the last couple of years. What's running Doom this week? However, I've got to say, I think this one is worthwhile of inclusion because I've never seen a lawnmower running an official version of Doom before until now.
I don't understand this. I don't get it. Like, I think lawnmower and I think, like, you know, the big orange Flymo in your back garden, you know, in your shed. But I'm guessing this is like one of these smart lawnmowers.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so mow the lawn for you.
In the lawnmower world, there's different types. Our British association of a lawnmower is, you know, a metal thing that you push around with sharp blades. That's pretty rubbish. In America, they sit on them and they have these huge ones that you can drive around on. And these seem to be robot ones. Now, this is really interesting. I went to Norway and I saw loads of these robot lawnmowers everywhere. And they were like cutting grass on hills and all these crazy kind of angles.
Yeah, so my neighbours have got them. I see them just out cutting the grass.
Well, there you go. Posh area, Dan.
robots. Yeah, I haven't got one. So my
Nick one.
Yeah, I mean, I really want one of these, actually, because, I mean, I hate cutting the grass. I'm awful at, like, you know, just finding the motivation to go out and do it. However, if I had one of these, I've got a feeling I'll be the missus. Yeah, yeah, I'll just go and set the electric lawnmower up. It'll do its thing. Then I come back in about 2 hours later, having played Doom on it. Because this is, now, it's an official port of Doom. Now, this is, I don't know how to pronounce it. Is this Husqvarna? I believe this is the auto mower.
I guess. Yeah, yeah. That sounds Nordic as well.
Well, these are basically, like you said, robot lawnmowers. So, you know, you set them up, I imagine, a bit like a Roomba does like vacuum cleaning. They go and do the lawn for you, go up and down, do it nicely. But weirdly, this company are sending an update to their mowers that you can get from the late summer this year. We can sign up to play from the 9th of April until the 9th of September 2024. They're going to be sending an update down that actually gives you a legit licensed version of Doom that you can play on the screen that's usually reserved for information on setting up your lawnmower. It actually appears on the little screen on the front of the mower. You can play Doom on there.
It's pretty interesting. So Dreamhack is a fantastic event, and that runs in Sweden. And it's been running since 1994, so 30 years old, that event is. And it looks like these lawnmower people actually put it on and bought it to Dreamhack.
Right.
And then previewed the Doom game to the world's biggest LAN, basically, which has probably got quite a few Doom players there as well. So, I don't know if it had online capabilities. Maybe you can have a lawnmower LAN match.
Well, it must do, because they're sending updates to this via Wi-Fi.
The way
you play, it's actually use the mower's onboard display and controls. It's got like a little control knob that normally used for like, you know, navigating the menus. You can use that for controlling the character and firing.
So you could be playing a game and the lawnmower could join in.
Yeah, I think you'd have to follow the lawnmower around your garden to play it.
Or mount it.
Yeah, that could be a good look. But yeah, what a weird thing though, to actually send this officially to an auto lawnmower.
I mean,
what's next, Joe?
What's next? No, I'm just speechless. I mean, it's a very expensive way to play. I'm looking at the prices of these lawnmowers. It starts at £3,500, their cheaper model is. But it's the fact that, you know, like you say, it's on the little screen, but then the buttons is just a dial.
Yeah.
You just control it with a little dial and there's a start button on there. And then maybe the dial clicks in. So it doesn't look like the best way to play
My
Doom.
Japanese toilet plays Doom. In the next one.
But I love the comments on the YouTube video here. Somebody's put, this is a genuine thing that was done with the big wigs in the suits on a PowerPoint presentation. They said yes to it. Like, obviously,
well,
it's just
I want one now, Joe.
Thing,
it's working on me, this. This market is working on me. £3,500 quid. Can you think of a better way to play Doom in the garden this summer?
No.
I can think of a cheaper way to mow your lawn.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a switch, but yeah, that could do the job. But yeah, I couldn't mow the lawn at the same time. So I think it's very cool. So yeah, that is going to, if you have got one of those lawn mowers, it's going to be available from April until September this year. So it could be a few summer days out in the garden. So you're going to check that out. I'll link that up. And of course, everything else we talk about, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job every week. Check the show notes on your podcast app or head to the website, theretrohour.com. Right, patrons, stay tuned. There are a couple more news stories on the way for you, because we do that for our patrons every week. We chop all the adverts out the podcast, so that means, you know, we don't want to shortchange you, so we give you another two or three news stories on the podcast each week. More of those coming up in just a second. And, of course, we are joined by the amazing John Riggs, our guest on the podcast. Before we do that, though, let's take a second to give a massive thank you to this week's sponsor, and it is our wonderful friends at Shopify. Now, being Shopify users, you'll know exactly what that sound means. You guys are smiling here and that.
I think I'm playing Habbo.
It means you've made a sale.
Of course it does. It means you've just made some money on Shopify. Now, if you're not familiar with Shopify, this is the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Because you know what it feels like right now, particularly with, you know, the cost of everything going up recently, feels like everyone I know at the moment is starting a side hustle. Now, Joe, you're doing your retro gaming market, selling stuff like that. I've got a friend of mine who's started selling t-shirts. I've got friends that have been doing books recently. Feels like everyone is doing a side hustle, or even better, maybe becoming your own boss at the moment too. And Shopify really takes all of the headache out of doing it for you. And it's revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Now, we've been talking before about seeing these little card readers at, you know, retro gaming markets, a lot of people, rather than, you know, because no one carries cash anymore, a lot of the traders now just taking little card payments using Shopify readers. I saw them at my village Christmas market a couple of months ago as well. And even for selling them online, I mean, if you run a website, Ravi's got experience of, you know, used to do website design for a living, trying to set up your own e-commerce platform is not a small job.
Absolute nightmare, yeah. And the problem is as well, if that goes down, you know, people are going to lose sales. Reliability is really important, and you know, having support as well for 24 hours.
Yeah, which Shopify give you. They've got, you know, full courses so you can learn it all. They've got that 24-hour support available as well. And industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth and give you complete control over your business. And the good thing is, with Shopify, you don't have to learn any new skills, no design or coding, nothing like that needed. They'll take care of it all for you and are ready to support your success in every step of the way. So however big you want to grow, Shopify will be there to empower you with the confidence and control to take your business to the next level. So if you want to get serious about selling, get Shopify today. And of course, you know we get you the best offers. So if you head to this link right now, exclusive to the podcast, you'll be helping us out and you'll get it for just £1 a month. You can try out Shopify for a £1 a month trial period. Head to shopify.co.uk/retrohour. That is all lowercase, shopify.co.uk/retrohour to take your business to the next level today and get ready to hear lots of this. And we thank Shopify for their continued support. Okay, next, we are joined by this week's special guest, the very talented John Riggs, talking about his massive YouTube channel, his homebrew games, his love for the NES and the retro breakfast cereal, and lots more. He's coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest, and that we're so honoured to be joined by the incredibly talented John Riggs. Of course, I'm sure you know from his hugely successful YouTube channel, his amazing community contributions, those homebrew titles, Rig Games, his love for the NES. We're going to try and cover all of that and more as well, fingers crossed, over the next hour with John. So great to have you on, John. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I was just in the UK not even a month ago, and always love to hear a familiar voice, I suppose.
Yeah, so we were going to get into that because I know you actually won an award over here in the UK.
Yeah.
At an event, so we'll talk about that in a second because you were in our hometown of Nottingham. So before we get into all that, though, and of course the great work that you do on YouTube, we always like to kind of wind it back to day one with our guests and kind of find out where your journey began. I mean, do you remember your earliest video game memory? Is that something that you recall?
Oh, it was a long, long time ago. I was born in 1977, which was the year the Atari 2600 was released. But my very first memory was in the arcade and playing Donkey Kong, the arcade machine. And I know in my memory, I know I've played it before, but I just remember seeing Donkey Kong and saying, oh, I think I'm going to play Donkey Kong, and walking up to it and playing it. So I'm sure I've had more video game memories before that. But that's my earliest memory, is spending most of my time in the arcade. That's kind of what we had at the time.
I read you grow up in the Palm Springs of Washington. What was the arcade scene like then, there where you grew up?
I like that. I like how you did your research. The Palm Springs of Washington, it's Yakima, Washington. Yakima is the Palm Springs of Washington. It's a huge practical joke that everyone's in on here. There was a local farmer who put up a sign by the freeway saying, "Welcome to Yakima, the Palm Springs of Washington," because it's totally not. It's the complete opposite. But it's a joke we all own up to here in Yakima. We had a few arcades. We had our local mall, which had, you know, probably our most famous arcade for people who grew up in Yakima during those days. It's called Jolly Joker, and it was fine. There's another kind of mall downstairs. There's another mall. Or another arcade downstairs from that wasn't as populated. And there's another arcade at the other mall as well. And then we had this mall I really liked to attend, but my mom didn't like me going there because smoking, it was during the 80s where smoking was like socially acceptable, like indoors. So it was this really seedy, shady, smoke-filled arcade. But it was the arcade that had Bubble Bobble. So I loved going there because I loved Bubble Bobble at the time. But,
amazing game. I loved Bubble Bobble as well.
I don't come home smelling like cigarette smoke. So I had to, you know, take the good with the bad, I suppose. But yeah, I don't know. Outside of that, growing up, especially here in the United States in the 80s, it was during a time where, arcades aside, every restaurant, every grocery store, every mini mart, just about any place you could think of would have one or two arcade machines there too. So I could just kind of have to keep track and keep my friends posted, and they'll tell me like what's going on. Oh, you know, this place over here just got the, you know, this arcade machine or whatever. So we'd look out for each other as well to find out where all the games were.
You know, in terms of home systems, have you kind of always been a gamer, or did you get to a stage where maybe you took a bit of a break and then got back into it? Or have you always liked to look back on like retro systems? Did you keep them all, or did you ever get rid of them? How did that kind of work your interest in retro?
Well, I've always had a passion for it. I came from a big family. I'm the sixth of seven children growing up in a giant house with one TV. Because, again, during the 80s, you'd only have one TV. Like, you know, it'd be like having more than one microwave. Why would you have more than one microwave? You only need one. So in our house, we just had the one television that we all kind of shared. I remember we'd have to take turns too, because both of my brothers and my two sisters were also big fans of video games. I think I was the biggest fan, but I have a brother of mine who's also a very big fan too. He's also a retro collector too. And we'd have to take turns. But on top of that, yeah, we have other hobbies. I enjoyed playing basketball. I would just, you know, the general hang out with friends and watch movies and all that too. But the passion of mine where I realized, you know what, video games is like my favorite thing to do in the world. That kind of came a little bit later when I got my own television and then I could spend as much time on video games as much as I needed. So long as I did my homework too. Yeah, it was a beautiful thing.
And was the NES your favorite system growing up, would you say? Because obviously you've got a big affiliation with it on your YouTube channel.
It became my favorite system. I grew up with the Atari 2600. That was my, so I had the Atari 2600 first. I probably got ours, I think probably 1981 had to have been. It was right around when Pac-Man first came out. Because I remember like Pac-Man was the big selling unit for the Atari at that time. So right around then. And that was just, it was, again, and you know, with all the games that we could play, you know, we'd also play like two-player games on it too. Growing through, they got to the point when finally the NES came out, and I got mine pretty late. I didn't get my NES until probably late 1988, maybe early.
Oh, okay.
I don't think early 89, but probably like late 88 sounds about right. And it blew my mind. Like just, I was like, to me, it was like one-to-one arcade graphics with what you could play at home. More than Atari, where it's like, well, you can play it in the arcade, you can play it at home. It's kind of two different experiences, but it's a close enough, reasonable facsimile thereof to be like, yeah, it's good enough. But yeah, like when I saw Super Mario Brothers in the arcade for the first time, which is the first time I ever saw it, and then I saw it on the NES at home, I was like, this is the same game. It's like, you know, it may as well just be the same game. So, the NES, and then even, you know, going to Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis, I was a huge fan of the TurboGrafx-16. And then other consoles too. I would always find myself going back to playing, you know, the classic games on NES, well, and Super Nintendo and everything else too. But always had a fondness for the NES. It's kind of like your favorite band of all time is probably the band you listen to the most in high school.
Yeah.
It happens to be that way. So it kind of came from that where it's like, you know, like playing that brought back all, you know, always brings back all the great memories of growing up.
Well, let's spin forward a few years then to the start of your YouTube channel. So obviously, you know, you're a passionate gamer. How did you decide to start a channel and what made you want to pick a camera up and start recording videos for YouTube? How did that start?
It started with my friend Jason, who's on YouTube. He's Metal Jesus Rocks. He's another guy in the Northwest. We go to the same video game conventions. I knew him from that. And I knew he had a YouTube channel, but even at the time, I didn't really watch YouTube for shows. It didn't make any sense to me. I'd like look up old music videos from MTV or something. But I never thought about using it like for all these people who are, you know, making kind of their own shows, their own programs, using YouTube as the medium. But Metal Jesus Rocks already had a channel and he would invite his friends on there. And I knew him just from the conventions. And one time we were just chatting and it was back when I first started hacking Nintendo games to like replace characters and replace graphics and things. And I was like, well, I can put you in a video game if you'd like. Now I asked him what kind of games he likes. He likes shooters. So I started mentioning all these Japanese games, all these Famicom games that came out that were the kind of shooters he would like, but didn't come out of the United States. So if somebody did play it or if he played it, it would be like playing a brand new game. It's just I would swap out the spaceship for him flying on a guitar or something. and I made the game too. But after coming up with all these games for the Famicom, I was like, well, we can do this one, that one. You know, like Over Horizon's a great one. Paradius is kind of fun, but maybe not that one so much. That's when he was like, you know a lot about Japanese video games. And my other friends, not as much. Like, not as much as you, anyway. He's like, do you want to come on my channel and talk about, you know, import video games? Like, for the Famicom, for Super Famicom? I was like, yeah, absolutely. I'm, you know, no problem at all. And I think maybe he knew or didn't know or something that, you know, I come from a radio broadcasting background. So it was very easy for me to talk in front of a camera. And I can talk about all day about anything, really. So after we did it, like, you know, first take, he was like, wow, that was really easy. Do you want to come back and do more? I was like, sure. And the more I kept coming, so I was on his channel before I even had my own channel. He was the one who said, you know, you could start your own channel too. You have all these games, you have all these, you know, all these memories and everything. You could start your own YouTube channel. I was like, yeah, maybe I will. So, you know, he was the major inspiration for me starting my own channel. I think he was just sick of me coming over to his place all the time. It was easy for me because I just had to show up and talk about video games. He does all the editing. But then once I saw kind of what he did, I was like, well, I can do that, you know, sure. So that's kind of where my channel started anyway.
That's fantastic. Was that the same with a little bit off topic, but with John Hancock as well? Is that how his channel kind of started as well? Literally going on Jason's. Yeah.
Same with Reggie. Same with many people who were on his channel and started their own channel. It was because, you know, we were on his channel first. And, you know, after a while, it's like, well, you know, I can do that too. And why not? So he was very instrumental to, you know, getting a lot of people started with channel. Then he'd also have some tips or insight with how YouTube works. Like some YouTube philosophy from, you know, from those days too. So it worked out pretty well for a lot of us. And then a lot of us still know us as being on his channel too, which is fine by me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I know you. I've been following you for a few years. I've been following Metal Jesus for about 8 years now, maybe.
Sure.
And I remember, you know, you guys all popping up on the channel and stuff like that. And then suddenly, oh, they've got their own channels and they're growing big and stuff. So it's wonderful to see. Speaking of your channel, obviously you put stuff out pretty much almost every day, every other day, and you cover such a wide range of topics on there, obviously game repairs to breakfast cereals, which I love as well. How do you decide on what content to produce next, and where do you find the time to just keep making those videos all the time?
It's all time management. It's all, you know, all, I don't go to the movie theaters. I don't binge watch series on Netflix. There's a lot of things that most, I would say, typical people do that just aren't interesting to me at all. Like, I would rather, you know, film for YouTube and edit and, you know, post something that's kind of fun. It's something that I'd want to watch anyway. And other people seem to gravitate towards. A lot of the videos I do, I'm able to just, you know, film. My editing is very simple. It's not Hollywood style. You know, there's no frills, no gimmicks, you know, nothing, no bells and whistles, nothing fancy about it. It's just, here's a bunch of video games and here's, you know, I'll just kind of let the gameplay footage do the talking. I mean, I do the talking, but let the gameplay footage, you can see what I'm talking about. And so many of those are so easy for me to almost just kind of throw together that, you know, when inspired, I can just whip up something and then, you know, I usually have it ready to go like the next day. Very rarely do I like take, you know, a day or two or three to edit the same video, I suppose. But it just comes down to, you know, just having the time to do all that. And I do have a full-time job and I have children, and the YouTube part is fun for me. So it's always, you know, fun for me to do that. And then the inspiration comes from, if I do a video that did well, oh, perfect. Well, the good news is, all of the video games I talk about have already been released. So I'm not, you know, like, oh, I can't wait to play this new game so I can talk about it. It's like, no, all the games are already out. That's good news. That's one of the benefits of being kind of a retro YouTuber who talks about the all these classic video games. So when it comes to, like, I just recently released a video that were, here's a bunch of Sega Genesis games, Mega Drive to you. Here's a bunch of Sega Genesis games that you forgot about, or this games that nobody talks about. And it's doing pretty well. So now I was like, oh, cool. Now I can do the same video for Nintendo. I can do the same video for the Super Nintendo. I can do the same video for the arcades, even. I could do the same video for all these other consoles. And that's so it kind of, you know, kind of writes itself. And then I always get, you know, great suggestions from the comments as well.
I love those kind of videos too, because obviously there's a lot of games that we've played a million times on these retro systems. Sure. But actually, I enjoy finding kind of forgotten gems and stuff that maybe is a bit left of center. I mean, you know, when you're exploring titles to cover on your channel, is there anything that kind of makes a game stand out to you? I imagine you probably don't want to do the, you know, the Sonic the Hedgehog 2s that have been covered a million times, that kind of thing.
Well, and sometimes you almost have to talk about them just to acknowledge them. It's like, but, you know, sometimes I'll use that as the standing point. So like, well, everybody's heard of Sonic the Hedgehog 2, but if you love Sonic, then you'll probably like Socket is another game that came out for the Mega Drive that plays just like Sonic the Hedgehog. It was one of the games I featured on my channel, but it's just the game that nobody talks about, you know, or say, but, you know, Super Mario Brothers 3, where everyone knows Mario 3. But if you like that style of game, then here are like 10 other games that are a lot like it, maybe not as good, but you've already played Mario 3. So it'll hopefully kind of re-spark that interest in, you know, those style of games. So it's always fun to see, you know, what all is out there. And I love seeing the comments too. I love seeing the comments of people saying like, oh, hey, that game looks great. I can't wait to find it. Or the people who say, oh my God, I completely forgot about that game. I forgot my cousin had that game and I played it once at his cabin 30 years ago. And I was trying to find the name of it and I couldn't think of it. And there it is. So those are the ones I liked. Because for me, it's all nostalgia. It's all memory. And I love kind of unlocking those memories from other people too.
I love that. I also love your open cart surgery. I find it quite therapeutic.
Yeah, that started literally from somebody sent me a bunch of broken video games, and I would just fix them without YouTube. I would just do them on the side. I'd get these games in. I might find them at a flea market or at a convention, and maybe they're not working, or even sometimes on eBay. On eBay, they would list like a video game as is, broken, untested, and 99.9% of the time, it's just cleaning them. And those always make the most boring videos, I think. But for a while there, I was just doing that anyway, just to do this. And I thought to myself, well, I mean, since I'm doing this anyway, I may as well film it and post it and see what happens. And so I started the open cart surgery type videos almost as a throwaway video series. I was like, well, I'm just going to do this anyway, and I'll just do this, and here we go. And for a while there, it was what people liked most on my channel. So I don't do them as often as I used to. I still try to do at least maybe one a month if I can. But it's just it just started out as a thing that I've been doing. Even video rental stores in the 90s, I had a good relationship with the one down the street from my house where they would always, people would bring in a game. Maybe the piece of plastic broke off in the inside and say, oh, this game's broken. It's not working. And they don't question it. They just put it in a pile and they'll get to it later. They never get to it, though. But I was just like, I can fix those for you. So, you know, they trusted me enough to take home this giant stack of video games, and I fixed them and I brought them back and said, well, these two definitely don't work. But all these ones are actually just fine. I just cleaned them up. So I was able to do that in exchange for free video game rentals. And it worked out pretty well.
Is there any kind of common points of failure in a lot of the cards that you look at? I mean, like batteries, for example.
Yeah, I mean, most of the time it's just cleaning them for the most part. A lot of Game Boy games, it's the, you just have to re-solder like the solder points. It's just, I don't know if it's just like, I've heard the term cold solder. That's the other thing too. I'm not kidding when I say I don't have a clue what I'm doing. I don't have a tech background. I don't know why any of it works. But I can put puzzles together really well. So if I can just, you know, do kind of just the troubleshooting that I typically do. Yeah, sometimes, I mean, outside of cleaning them, sometimes it is, you know, sometimes even with the battery, the game should still, I mean, I would think the game would still work even if there wasn't a battery there. It just won't save. But while you're in there anyway, you may as well replace the battery. We have a couple of video game stores in the Seattle area that every time they put out a game on the shelf, like, let's say, Earthbound, they will always replace the battery up front, just so you know. So if you're getting a copy of The Legend of Zelda, you know it's going to have a new battery, because those batteries aren't supposed to last, you know, 20 years. And we're already over that part for that mark for many of these classic cartridge-based video games. So they, you know, replacing the battery while you're in there, sometimes it is just, you know, reflowing the solder points because the solder has been kind of dormant for, you know, so long that just in doing so, it kind of reactivates it. I don't know how that works, though. It's all magic to me, and I'm the one looking at it. The good news is, even if the game doesn't work, I'll post the video anyway, because there are way smarter people than me in the comment section. And that's how the internet works. If you want to know how to do something right, do it wrong on the internet, and you'll be corrected. Corrected immediately.
Yeah, somebody will quickly tell you. I love that.
And I love it. And I love all the insight. I mean, that's how I'm learning too. So it works out great.
That's brilliant. So obviously your channel's, you know, getting pretty big with 200,000 followers now. Which is absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
Was there anything like a particular video that significantly impacted your channel and made it big? Or do you think, you know, kind of like your journalism and radio background contributed towards this? Or do you think it's just consistency?
I think it's all consistency. In fact, going back to open cart surgery, and this is a true story. When I started doing the open cart surgery videos, and especially when I started attending video game conventions, that's one of my favorite things to do in the world is, I love to travel. I love to visit these conventions. I love to talk to people, you know, like on like one-to-one, maybe go out to the pub, grab a drink or something. Every time I'd go to these video game conventions, the top two compliments I would always get were, I like it when you try to fix broken video games, and I like it that you have your kids on your channel because you're a family-friendly channel. So I was like, perfect. I will give the people what they want. And this is a little bit of like YouTube philosophy now. I was like, I'll give the people what they want. Nothing but open cart surgery videos. I'm going to do more unboxing videos with my kids because that's fun for us. And I'll just do that. And my channel stopped growing because I was super serving the existing audience. The audience was already there. So, of course, the people who are seeing me at conventions, the one who are like, hey, I recognize you for this channel because of these things. They're already subscribed. They're already watching. So the views were fine. The comments were fine, but my subscribers weren't growing because all of my videos were the same style of video. It's when I branched out a little bit saying, you know what, I'm just going to start talking about random games. And hopefully, like if I talk about here's 10 Super Nintendo games you forgot you rented or whatever, or here's 10 Nintendo games that you can play without knowing Japanese. then that's when you start being suggested by YouTube. Like, maybe they'll watch a much bigger channel than mine. Then I'll be like, oh, hey, if you like this channel, maybe you'll like this channel. For a while there, I was being recommended by these other tech channels, which was bad news for me, because that's when, you know, again, the tech channels who actually know what they're doing versus me, who was just doing it for entertainment, saying, well, let's see what this works. Oh, that didn't work. Oh, well, I'll just throw it in the garbage. Which is just the complete opposite of what they wanted. Turned out to my disadvantage by being suggested by other tech channels. But when I started being suggested by other, you know, gaming channels, then I started growing a little bit more and a little bit more. And again, you just look for those videos that seem to work. And when you find those videos that are like the hidden gems, like you talk about, perfect. I can do a hidden gems for the TurboGrafx-16. I can do a hidden gems for the GameCube, you know, or the Game Boy, whatever. So you just kind of go from there, and, you know, hopefully, ride the coattails of the last video that you published.
Well, one interesting project you were involved with was the retro game hunting film The Bits of Yesterday. So can you tell us a bit about your role in that and kind of what the film's impact was on the retro gaming community? How well was that received?
You know, I think it was received pretty well. What happened was the director reached out to a few people that he knew on social media and said, hey, I'm directing this film. He was an aspiring film director, inspired by other kind of indie film directors as well. And he can do that. Anybody can do that. But he actually went out and did that. So props to Darren for doing that. And, you know, it worked out pretty well. It was, I think, the first, I'm pretty sure that was the first video game documentary. I've been at a few of them now, but that was the first one that I was in. And though he flew around a little bit and chatted with other people who were game collectors. And that's the other thing, is I don't consider myself a game collector. I have a collection, but I'm not like actively seeking certain things for a collection. Mm-hmm. I just like to talk about the games I have. You know, I happen to have a collection, of course, you know, but not so much of that. So, but we happened to be at the same place. It was the Portland Retro Gaming Expo, which takes place in Portland, Oregon, on the west side of the United States. And we both happened to be there. He happened to have his camera. So he's like, oh, I'll just set up a tripod here and I'll ask you a few questions. And, you know, he tried to ask me the questions in between, you know, they're also playing, like, you know, 80s music on the overhead speakers. So, you know, in between the Hall & Oates and all that, we're, you know, trying to quickly answer and ask questions.
Nice.
You know, back and forth. And then that was it. And then after a while, after, you know, the editing was all done, then the movie was published and produced. And it was like, oh, cool. It's kind of fun to see that, because, you know, I see myself on YouTube often enough. But then here I am now, you know, on a DVD, on something, on another, you know, physical, tangible item. And it was a fun project to be a part of.
So you mentioned earlier on the kind of how you got to know Metal Jesus Rocks, and you did your ROM hack for him and stuff like that.
Yeah.
How did you get started with your ROM hacks, and what was the first game, and what's the process like there? How'd you start? Sure. How'd you get into that?
And that's one of the things where I got my YouTube channel started, was showing people how to do their own ROM hacks too.
Mm.
But how that happened was I'm familiar with, like, NES games for sure, and then Famicom games. And then I started seeing people kind of deconstructing and recreating their own Nintendo games by hacking them, by changing the physics, by changing the graphics. Mm. And I've seen a lot of them. And they came to my child and I. I don't know if it was popular in the UK or not, but we had a children's cartoon called Adventure Time.
And
so I was watching Adventure Time, a young boy with his anthropomorphic dog who can kind of change shape.
Mm.
And then I went to the internet and said, oh, hey, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, somebody should make a hack of a boy and his blob, but replace the boy and his blob with Finn and Jake from this cartoon. And the internet, being the internet, was like, why don't you do it? And I was like, you know, why don't I do it? I never thought about that. I could figure out how to do this. I mean, if somebody can do this, and I've seen all the naked Mario hacks, I've seen all the, you know, there's a Super Mario Brothers 2 hack where you play as the Beatles. There's all these kind of obscure hacks out there. I was like, well, certainly if it can be done, I can figure it out. So unfortunately, the internet, also being the internet, a lot of the forums for how to kind of modify video games were written in very technical terms that I didn't quite understand. Which is why I did my YouTube videos, where it's like, look, in layman's terms, I'll show you how I do it. I'm sure there's a better way, but it works for me. And I started, that's why I started doing that. And the first game I did was just for a friend of mine. It was very simple, Super Mario Brothers. I removed Mario, put his son in there, changed the title screen. I don't even think I changed the title screen at the time. That's how early it was. Mm. And I did that, and then that was that. And then the other good news is I knew how to make my own reproduction cartridges. So one, it's one thing that you can do that. You can play the ROM. You can put the ROM in your EverDrive. You can put the ROM wherever you want. But then, you know, the added value of, oh, now I can put it back onto a cartridge, so you have a physical NES cartridge that you can pop into your Nintendo system to play this game hack. That kind of makes it, you know, a reality to a lot of people, or, you know, a dream come true for some who have always wanted to be in a video game, and now you can make that happen, you know, to an extent, I suppose. So all these years later, I learned how to do that almost 10 years ago now. It's been about 10 years, yes, now that I think about it, that I started doing that, and still to this day, I never did do the Adventure Time hack of a Buena's Blob.
Oh, wow.
There's still time, Joe.
I was able at least to do that and then to do a couple of other things. And that's just kind of how I got started with what eventually became just, you know, started working on my own NES projects was, and Toby Fox was the same way. Toby Fox famously made Undertale, but he was also the guy who did the Halloween hack of Earthbound. Mm. So, you know, kind of got started that way, where it's like, well, at first I'll just start hacking my own video games. And then after a while, it's like, okay, if I can kind of like Frankenstein, you know, building Frankenstein's monster, if you replace all of the limbs, it becomes a new person. So if I replace all of the items, maybe it can become a new video game. I just need someone to help me with the brain of it all. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, cause I know over the last, you know, decade, your involvement in the indie scene and, you know, indie and retro kind of go hand in hand anyway.
Right.
You've become really involved in it in the last decade or so. Recently, I know you've been working with Low Tech Games, who do a lot of great indie games for the Dreamcast and the NES. Tell us a bit more about your collaboration there then. How did that come about?
I wanted to have a video game where you sympathize with the treasure chest mimic. I've always loved the mimic character from video games. I take that back. I've always hated the mimic character in video games.
Right.
But I figured, well, but it's kind of a, you know, it's a well-known enough creature that it would be nice if they made their own video game. Like, it would be nice if the mimic had its own game where you can play as literally that. And so I started thinking of all these ideas of, you know, maybe you can use the tongue to dart around, you know, to catch the gems in the room or something, or maybe you can kind of scoot it around. And in my brain, what I thought of was more of like an Indiana Jones adventure style game, a little bit like a Quirk. I was thinking Quirk in my mind, which is a Game Boy game I really like, where we had to, like, you know, you push the block into the hole so you can walk across the block, and then you have to use a ladder to get somewhere. But every stage would end with you going to the treasure chest, which happens to be a mimic who eats you. And then the next stage is doing it all over again. And so I pitched that idea to a few people. And Alistair from Low Tech Games was the first one I pitched it to. And I kind of brought up my idea. And then he very casually, in very Alistair form, he was just like, oh, you mean a little bit like a, like, you mean like Choo Choo Rocket? And I was like, oh, my God, even better. Exactly like that. Now, never mind everything else I was thinking about. That's the only thing I could think of when I was an insane fan of Choo Choo Rocket, especially for the Dreamcast. I played it a lot on the Game Boy Advance, too. And I was like, oh, if we could do like a Choo Choo Rocket game where instead of the mice going to the rocket launch pad, it was like an adventurer, and ended up becoming knights. If it was like the person going to the mimic who at the end would be eaten and then you move on to the next stage, I think that'd be even funnier. So it started with that, and at the moment, he was like, well, I'm a little busy right now working on some other projects. He's always working on like 9 games at a time. But the more I don't know if it was the more he thought about it or something. I don't know. But at first, he didn't quite decline, but he was like, well, I'm pretty busy right now. But, you know, and during the time, I also pitched it to Dale Coop, who has done many NES homebrews, and several others as well. But at the end of the day, because it was that Choo Choo mimic thing, I mean, really, Low Tech Games was the one I really wanted involved with this project. You know, I would have been happy with anyone, but I know he could bring that, just that little bit of extra something. And especially when we started coming up, he showed me like a mock-up, like a quick, like, well, you know, maybe if we do it this way and we could design the levels using the same program he uses to make like Tapeworm or Flea, which is also a plug-and-play thing that we could both work on at the same time. Then it kind of became a, because at first I was just like, you know what, if you code the game, I will do all the other work. I can do graphics, I can do music, I can do everything else. And the more we talked about it, the more he was like, actually, instead of like just coding it, like, do you want to just like go like half and half? Like, we'll just go partner on this game. I was like, you know what, I'd love that even more, because I love Flea. I am an insane Tapeworm fan. Tapeworm may be my favorite NES game, NES homebrew of all time. I love Tapeworm. And I just like the other projects. I love his art style. And we're both huge fans of puns. We love the worst puns, the better. We love the dad jokes. that's how we speak to each other all weekend long whenever we see each other at conventions. So that's how it came about. And then, you know, and I learned a little bit along the way too, from this whole process, and it worked out great for both of us, I think.
That's brilliant. So obviously, you know, you kind of started out with your hacks on the NES and these games have developed from there. Some of these games, such as Choo Choo Mimic, have landed on the Evercade, which, you know, we love the Evercade. We're talking about the Evercade pretty much every week on the podcast at the moment.
Oh, I love
it. It's just fantastic. And obviously these games have developed into GBA titles, Dreamcast titles. What's the development process there? Are you involved in that, or is that Low Tech Games and Alistair is that?
You know, I think we can both do that. How that comes about is once you have the NES ROM, it's very easy to port that NES ROM to just about anything you'd want. Now, he took care of the Playdate, and that's one thing I didn't have my hands in. But he was like, oh, and I'll put it over to Playdate too. Perfect. I mean, the more consoles, the better. So it's available on Playdate. And then when I had my previous game, Yeah Yeah Beavis 2, on Evercade as well, and then he had Flea and Tapeworm on Evercade. So, so it was just a no-brainer as long as, you know, they gave the approval, which, you know, of course they did. And Stream as well came about, too. But it's like, so long as you have that NES ROM, you can port the NES ROM to, you know, to run it through, you know, in all transparency, basically a Nintendo, like a NES emulator. So it plays on the Dreamcast or, you know, the same thing. So it plays on Game Boy Advance. It just involves, it's just that extra step. So something like Playdate takes a little bit more coding. But then like something like Dreamcast or Game Boy Advance, you know, it was easy just to, you know, almost convert the ROM. You still have to change some of the in-screen text because to make it match like a Dreamcast controller, for instance, versus an NES controller. You know, and then later on, we all plan on putting it on Steam and Switch and everything else that we can too. But again, it involves that extra help of something that's out of my control. But I have friends who can, so that's when it all comes to the networking.
It's interesting to hear about, you know, mapping it to different controllers because the Playdate, I imagine, is in a completely different world to all the rest of them, because that's kind of got that winch on the side, hasn't it? The handle that you can turn.
Oh, you're sure, yeah. Absolutely. So, I mean, and you'll see that sometimes too, and it's just as easy as you can just change the end screen, like the in-game text or the in-game, you know, like visuals. If there is a, like, you know, this button does this, well, you just have to change, you know, from a B to an A or to, you know, from a B to a Y on the Dreamcast, you know, something like that.
Well, Choo Choo Mimic was very well received. You actually won a Retro World Award for that too. That must have been very rewarding to get that accolade.
I 100% didn't think it was going to happen. I was just happy to be there. When I heard that Debug, they make this wonderful indie magazine there in the UK, and they said, hey, you know what, we're going to start our own award show. And that's the beautiful thing, is you don't have to wait for another games award to, you know, and they're a very popular one in the US, and the indie title almost goes underneath their breath. In between all the other trailers and all the commercials and all the paid advertising, then all of a sudden it's like, oh, here's the indie game of the award. It could be this, and this is the winner. Here we go. And done. And that's it. And so I think they put it in their own minds to say, look, indie games are the wave of the future. You hear about all these layoffs every day from all these major companies. The beautiful thing about the indie developers is if there's going to be a layoff, it's because you fired yourself, you know, so you don't have to wait for someone else to step in. So when it came about that they were going to have a retro category or any other category too, I was like, well, I mean, Choo Choo Mimic was, you know, we're still working on getting like the CIB copies for NES. You can get it loose right now, but, you know, everything else. But since it was available on Evercade through their Game of the Month program, as well as Playdate, it officially came out last year. So for the the calendar year of 2023. You know, we threw Choo Choo Mimic in there as well. And, you know, I told one of the organizers of the event, who I hadn't met yet, I was just like, this, I mean, it's a long shot. I know there's gonna be a lot of great competitors because it's not just like Nintendo games. I mean, there's gonna be games that are there for, you know, for Steam, for Playdate, for any console, really, so long as it has that indie vibe to it. You know, games that are on Game Pass right now. It's like I'm competing with games that are like on Xbox and PlayStation. So it's like I'm happy just to be in there. But there is a retro category for physical games made for, you know, a couple of the games that were in there were available for the Atari 2600. You know, it could be anything. And there's a game on there for Dreamcast. And I was like, you know what? The game that was available for Dreamcast, Driving Strikers, great game. It's really a fun game. It's definitely worth checking out. It's on Steam also, but they had it on Dreamcast. So that was also up for an award for the Retro World at the indie Debug Indie Game Awards. I was like, that's probably going to be the one that wins, because that's like, that has the home field advantage, being it was made in the UK. Some of the programmers are also part of like Debug in a way, not directly involved, but still, like, you know, like Wave Studios and Wave does some things with a Debug and everything. So it's like, well, I'm just happy to be a part of it. And the fact that it was even nominated, I was like, hey, you know, since it's nominated, that gives me the excuse to fly to the UK, you know, go to Nottingham. I've never been to Nottingham, get to hang out there for a few days. And yeah, to my surprise, and not to my surprise, was when they said, well, we're not even the judges here. I mean, the people who are judging are all these outside sources from all over the world. Who don't have, you know, they don't have a hand in the pot in the first place. So, they, you know, it doesn't matter to them who wins or loses. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, you know, I'll give it a shot. So I'm glad I arrived. Glad I showed up, because I was just filming it just for the good of the cause and just happy. I mean, honored to be nominated in the first place. Yeah. But when they actually said the name out loud, I truly believe what Einstein says, where time is relative.
Yeah.
Where when they said the name, I was like, there's no way they actually said that name. And then I had to replay it again in my head. I was like, no, wait, they actually said that name. And I kind of looked around and I saw a couple of people looking at me. I was like, I think I was supposed to go up on stage now. I better
go. Totally not prepared.
I'm going Alistair. And it's funny because Alistair and I were sitting on opposite ends of the auditorium too. Not by nature of we hate each other. It's just, you know, he found his seat with some friends and a friend of mine, Nate, from the US. He was also there because he had one of his games up for nomination as well. I was like, and we both kind of convinced ourselves. We're just like, our game is not going to win, but man, what a fun experience to be here. And sure enough, it happened. He was like, I think you should go up there. I was like, okay. So it worked out pretty well. And now for the rest of our time, Choo Choo Mimic, we can always say is a, you know, an indie, the Debug Indie Game Award winner. We put that sticker right on the box if we want to.
Oh, you should be very proud of that as well. And the fact that, you know, these games are now being recognized so much that you can attend international award shows just proves kind of how big the indie retro scene is now, doesn't it?
Oh, it really does. And growing exponentially. And I love it. So many people. And again, I get it. You know, people always talk about the big AAA titles, the big games, you know, the ones that are spending all the advertising and everything, the ones that are made by these full teams of, you know, 24/7 developers and all that. And, you know, but just there's something fun about just the, you know, the just made by fans. Like, we're fans first. And, you know, and there is no corporate, you know, we're not trying to appease the you know, the financial backers. We're not trying to, you know, go out of our way. You know, maybe the wife of the owner of the company says, oh, it would be nice if you put our dog in there. Well, sure, that is nice, and you can do things like that too. But, you know, when you're going out of your way to be your most creative artistic self, but you're still limited with, you know, because other people are paying for it, you know, that's got to take a toll on your own personal soul, I would think, after a while. You know, but when it's just, you know, it's Alistair and it wasn't just the two of us. It was Alistair and I, along with and Tui did the music, and I love his music. He did the music for Donut Dodo that came out recently, as well as Cash Cow DX is coming out soon. So it was cool to have somebody who has, you know, like all these great, like, you know, retro inspired indie games as well. And then he's also doing music for an NES console. And it's like, that's amazing, you know. I'm so proud of it. I'll at least say this. I've had some great accolades so far in my kind of content creator journey. I was in a documentary called Rarity, which won a Golden Award for its category. So I literally have a gold trophy because I was in that documentary. I have my 100,000 subscriber plaque from YouTube. I have all these other things, and they're all literally in the closet. But my Debug Indie Game Award plaque sits firmly on my wall in the background of my videos. So I'm very proud of that one.
That's lovely. That's
awesome.
For
Alistair and I. And we both got one, too. So it's not like I didn't have to break it in half or anything.
Snap it. I saw it, actually. Was it? I watched the video. Was it actually the award that you go to snap in half on stage?
I would have for him. No, it was... It was the, and they told us in advance, just like with anything else, they told us in advance, like we'll give you the one, but if you want a second one, then you can work through whoever makes the awards, frame a game, I think. Yeah, it's literally called Frame a Game, and you can get, you know, you can get your favorite video game framed, I suppose, if you'd like. But they did the awards, so it's like, we'll give you this one on stage. And if you want a second one, just contact the company; they'll send you a second one. Since I live in the U.S., he actually, you know, his address is in the U.K. Free shipping for him. I was like, well, I'll take this one home with me. And then I'll arrange it so they ship you one. So
yeah, at least you'd have to send it back and forth like every 6 months. Like, you have it for a few months, I'll have it for a few months.
That's right. He kept the envelope. They had the envelope with, like, and the winner is. So I was like, you can keep that one. I don't mind. Yeah, he likes having, you know, I think he likes having those in his room. He does that with when your game is featured on Evercade. They will also, you know, send you a shadow box with your game on it and everything. So yeah, that's fun.
So you have a love of retro cereal as well. Which is actually developed into a game, Cereal Caf, where you play as yourself, as well as a book on retro cereal.
That's true.
Tell us all about this.
You know, I've always been, I am as nostalgic for breakfast cereal as I am video games. It was just such a big part of my youth growing up. And like video games, not that I got out of it, but it wasn't until I had my own children walking down the cereal aisle when I was like, I don't remember that cereal. I don't remember that one. Oh, they still make that? Cool. Yeah, I'd go down the cereal aisle and I might buy the, at least here in the United States, we have things like Frosted Mini Wheats. I might buy the occasional box of that, you know, or Apple Jacks is a favorite of mine too. You know, things like that. But I never thought about, you know, the other cereal that came about. And it just had that wave of nostalgia of all of these great, mostly licensed cereals that, you know, we had in the U.S. growing up that just don't exist anymore. And that's when I started thinking about that. I was like, and it's funny, I never eat it for breakfast. It's more of a late night snack, or I just finished editing a video, so I'm going to watch my own video back before I post it. That's when the cereal bowl gets pulled out of the cupboard there. But when it came about that I had a game I could edit, and that was the whole idea behind the name Rigged Games, was I rig them, I modify them, I hack them. That's kind of where the name came. And my last name is literally Riggs, so it kind of dates back to, you know, the medieval times. If you're a blacksmith, your last name is Smith. If you're a baker, your last name is Baker. Well, I modify video games. I rig them to my advantage. So I guess my last name's Riggs. What happened was I had a couple of homebrew games that had existed previously as something else, but I had the rights to change the graphics and make it my own game and still sell it at conventions. And that's where Cereal Cafe came about. There was a previous version called Beer Slinger, where you're at a bar serving beer. So I was like, well, you know, like here in the U.S., we have Tapper and we have Root Beer Tapper for the children. I was like, well, you know, we can have Beer Slinger and then I can make the Cereal Cafe game where you're selling breakfast cereal. And I figured because I'm the fan of cereal, I'll put myself in that one just for fun.
That's awesome.
And the book came about only because we have all of these books about like toys of the 80s and video games of the 80s. And the cartoons and the movies of the 80s. But breakfast cereal becomes one of those things where once you start talking about it, you're like, at least here in the U.S., we'll be like, remember Smurf Toast Crunch? Or not Smurf Toast Crunch. We're like, remember Smurf Berry Crunch? Or, whatever happened to that? Like, wasn't there like a Strawberry Shortcake cereal? What about that Nintendo cereal that had like Mario on one side and Link on the other, Zelda on the other? You know, it becomes that part of that conversation. So I was like, you know, if anyone's going to be the one to do it, it'll be me. So... is it completely self-published? I would like to put it on Amazon sometimes. It's very easy to publish books on Amazon, but it's also very easy for me just to write the book, which I did in like a 3-day weekend. It was during the pandemic. And I was like, well, I'm going to be here anyway. So I wrote the entire book over a 3-day weekend. And I have a friend of mine who is an insane cereal box collector. I have a nice collection of cereal boxes, but his is way bigger than mine. And he was happy to take the photos for me, to provide the photos. And that's kind of what I had in mind. It was more of a coffee book style where it's like, you know, one page is a giant box of cereal, and then here's a bunch of text about it. Knowing full well, nobody's actually going to read the words. There are words there just in case. And then I just went through a self-publisher. We have a publishing company here in the U.S. that anybody can use, mostly for comics, but they can do comics, they can do magazines, they can do manga. And so I just kind of, you know, I'm terrible with business. I need to be better at business, but I do the thing where it's like, okay, if I buy this many books and I have to pay for it up front, if I sell 30 of them, then I'll break even. Yeah. So I just kind of have to work ahead. But then but I do the same with the video games too. Like the video games I make, you know, oftentimes I'll put them together myself. I'll buy my own parts. I no longer have to destroy old video games like we used to back in the day. But I use brand new flash boards. I use new shells. I have to get all the paper and everything too. You know, but you have to pay for it all up front. So it's money out of my pocket up front. But after I sell so many of them, okay, now I'm broke even. And then any extra money that comes in, I'll just use it to buy more parts, to make more video games. And it's what lets me travel around. It's the hobby that pays for itself.
Yeah, it's got to be something you're really passionate about. It's not, you know, you can't do that for the money. It's got to be something that you just love doing.
And, no.
Yeah, hopefully you'll make something you won't lose money.
Yeah, well, especially with anything that involves like circuit boards and computer chips. There's not a lot of markup there. I mean, you're barely walking away with like an extra for, you know, like a Milky Way candy bar or something to get out of it after, you know, once the profits come in. Yes, 100%. You can't be doing anything like that for the money because it's not there.
Well, you know, you talked about putting yourself into the cereal game. You also give your buyers a chance to get into a video game as well on Yeah Yeah BBs. Now, that came out on the Dreamcast, but you also offered to program buyers into the NES version of the game as well, which I think is quite cool. So what's kind of the story behind that game, and where did that idea come from to put the players in there?
Well, that one came about with I've worked very closely with Mega Cat Studios since before they were Mega Cat Studios, and Mega Cat Studios is one of the premier indie companies here in the United States. They do retro. They also do modern. The people behind Mega Cat Studios are heavy into retro.
Yeah.
Like, that's their passion. If they could just do retro, they would just do retro. But they also understand that putting games on Steam, on Xbox, that's what pays the bills. That's what pays their company. And it's a very small team. I've visited the studios before. It's a very small team of people. But they love the retro side of things. Before Mega Cat Studios, they had a homebrew NES game that was in super limited quantity. They only made 40 of them. They sold them exclusively at one video game convention for charity. That's the only time it was ever available. And I have a copy of it, and it's very fun. And that's when the whole rigged games idea was like, hey, you know, do you have any games that are laid around that aren't making money? You know, can I basically buy the rights off of you, like buy the ROM? And I'm going to change everything about the game. I just want the game's code. And I can change the graphics. I can change the color. I can change the text. I can change the title screen. I can do everything else. And that's when Mega Cat Studios, who, you know, I've always worked with, and I've always promoted their games on my channel, and I love what they do. That's kind of when they said, we don't typically do this, but let us code you a game from scratch, and then you can do whatever you want with that. And one of the things I wanted was a game that was a two-player simultaneous game, because I have, and I don't do it anymore, but there were times where somebody would reach out to me saying, hey, look, I know you can't do this, and I know you legally can't sell it, but can you make me a copy of Super Mario Brothers where you put me as Mario and my wife as Luigi? And I'd say, well, you can't, because Mario and Luigi use the same graphics. It's the same, if you change one, you change both. And so many two-player games on the NES are like that. So I wanted a game that had two distinctly different characters that you could edit. And that was really the reason why Yaya Beavis 2 came about, was I wanted a game where I could edit it for those purposes. So I could change the graphics. I could put, you know, like a boyfriend and girlfriend, or a father and their son or something as the two characters. And then the rest of the game is still fun, too. I really enjoy that game. I mean, I hope I'm biased a little bit, of course. But that's how that came about. And then even on the Switch version, that's when we realized, wait a minute, we can put multiple copies of the ROM on there. So if you have like Yaya Beavis 2 on Switch, you can play as the default characters just for fun. I love the Zhangxi like style. You know, I just love those characters. So that's why they're the main characters. But like, if you type in the Konami code, then you'll play as my wife and I, as, you know, player one and player two.
Oh,
so
awesome.
There's things that can be done. Yeah, like on the Switch, I think the Steam version does it too. There's a couple of other codes in there too, but so things like that. So really the game came about was because I wanted a game that I could edit to personalize and customize it for people, but the game by itself by default works just fine too. And then of course, when you customize it, sure, I can shoot them the ROM, but then I can also put it on, you know, as their own cartridge. And I've gifted a few at conventions too, like for other people's YouTube channels. So it's always kind of fun to see the look on their face when they realize, oh, this is, you know, it's a one of a kind. It's a one of one.
Yeah, I saw that on a Pixel Game Squad.
Yep.
With Riff and what's the other guy's name?
Yeah, Ricky.
Ricky. There we go.
Yeah.
I saw that. I saw when you did it for them as well, which is nice. Really cool. So obviously, as somebody who makes a lot of game hacks, repros, you know, and you mentioned that you buy the rights for them and stuff like that. What ethical considerations do you think are important in this space?
Well, I mean, it's someone else's property. So, I mean, that's also why I got to do indie games or, you know, making my own homebrews, or, you know, or working with a low tech or working with Mega Cat Studios was like, you know, in the early days, on the down low and stuff like that, you know, like the hack that I think a lot of people still remember, like they'll still ask if I have it, is I hacked Burger Time to be Bob's Burgers, which is a very popular cartoon here in the United States. So I did that, and they're like, oh, did you bring any of those? Can you sell those? I was like, I legally can't. And I kind of got to the point with my YouTube channel where it's like, okay, now it's the time where Nintendo might be knocking on my front door saying, hey, you know, you can't be doing this, right? So in lieu of looking for a cease and desist, I was like, I better not do that anymore. But if I make my own video games, then that's totally fine. But there has to be, you know, especially, you know, and people could argue, I suppose, with, you know, these old properties and Nintendo's not making any money on them. It's still kind of theirs, or belongs to someone anyway, you know. And then even more so when it comes to somebody's, you know, work on homebrews or indie games, or it's like, you know, it's you know, definitely support the artist.
And Nintendo are the ones that are generally most likely to come after you as well in our experience.
Oh, absolutely. Seen, yeah. Well, and it happens. Yeah. You hear about it several times a year. It's like, oh, this you know, somebody made a Pokemon. You know, this game heavily inspired by Pokemon. You know, it's a Pokemon love letter, and Nintendo shut it down. Like, well, of course they did. It's, you know, there, someone else is making money on Nintendo's property, you know, or something like that. So it's all for the right reasons. You know, I can't just show up and, you know, hear a song that maybe didn't get as popular, then call it my own, and then someone else later on. Or, you know, it happens to comedians all the time too. Like, a comedian will steal a joke and then they'll be found out about it. So Don't want to be that guy.
No, it's fair enough. And especially in this connected age where everything's online.
Everyone knows everything. That was one of the things that happened with BioForce Ape, which is a homebrew where it was a prototype. It was a found, discovered prototype. It was in the back of magazines. There's reviews for it. It never came out for the United States. It never came out on the NES. Mm. A game called BioForce Ape. So somebody made their own homebrew, but called it the prototype. Like, oh my God, I can't believe it. I found it. Here it is. And then, like, a few months later, they actually found the real prototype, proving the other guy was a liar. So I was like, you know, and that's, which is also how the name came about for Yeah Yeah Beebus 2, because there is no Yeah Yeah Beebus 1.
Right.
Yeah Yeah Beebus 1 is lost media. So I was like, you know what? And I'll respect that, and I'll make the sequel to the game that doesn't exist.
Well, and, you know, the last like 10 years that you've been doing the indie games, I mean, I've noticed that the Dreamcast does get a lot of love on the homebrew scene. The NES as well, you know, the Mega Drive / Genesis seems to get a lot. I've noticed not so much on platforms like the Super Nintendo, it seems, or, you know, the N64 doesn't seem to get quite as much love. I mean, have you kind of noticed this trend of like certain systems coming into vogue? For example, like the Game Boy Advance seems to be getting quite a bit of homebrew recently. And is there anything you kind of feel we should be looking out for? Any systems that you think might be getting more homebrew in the future?
You know, what's funny, I didn't realize how big the Dreamcast homebrew scene was until Yeah Yeah Beebus 2 came about on the Dreamcast, where I just had it on NES. That was good enough for me. And then I have a friend of mine here in the United States who can put them on a Dreamcast disc. So that's why I was like, oh, you know what, let's just, well, sure, we can. He was like, I can do 20 of them. I got parts. Perfect. So we just did 20 of them. Just kind of a low key, hey, if you want it on Dreamcast, here it is. And then it was because of that Wave Studios reached out to me saying, whoa, wait a minute, you have a game on Dreamcast? How come we didn't know about this? And I was like, well, it's on NES, but we just have to run on Dreamcast. It is no big deal. That's when Wave Studios were like, oh, actually, we can actually produce that for you, right? I was like, I didn't realize how big it was. I think it might be more bigger in the UK than the US, but it's still a very big fan base here in the United States. NES, for sure. I think, again, it's my favorite system growing up, and I think it's also the favorite system of many people my age growing up. So it's easy to have that, you know, that love for it, to produce a game on the NES, because that was, you know, that was your passion. And there's also creativity through limitations. So you can only have so many colors. You can only have so much for graphics. You can only do so much with sound. So you don't have, so you're not forced to go overboard to compensate for, you know, what the Super Nintendo can produce, or what the, even the Mega Drive to an extent. And there's a lot of great indie games coming out for Mega Drive recently. But when it comes to like Nintendo 64, I think it just becomes that extra bit of knowledge that maybe I don't have it, but if somebody does have like some 3D computing, especially with dealing with the Nintendo 64, a lot of this, I played a 64 game the other day that was just it was a Game Boy game, but was also ported to the Nintendo 64, because you can do that now. so there's things like that too. But I mean, I would love to see more Nintendo 64 support for the indie homebrew scene. But it also comes down to price too.
Yeah.
You know, how much does it cost to produce a Dreamcast disc versus producing a Nintendo 64 cartridge? I mean, even blank Nintendo 64 cartridges, you're looking at like $30.
Yeah.
Just like that. So, you know, Dreamcast is already wonderful. You can do a lot with the Dreamcast, and it comes down to that price. You know, they find that magical price point where then it also makes it affordable to the person purchasing the game versus buying a brand new, like, hey, here's a Game Boy game on Nintendo 64. Not knocking the idea, but you're also paying Nintendo 64 prices for a Game Boy game.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Hard to come up with that, but I would love to see more 64 support. You know, and like you said, Game Boy Advance is still fun, and portable, and I think it's cheap enough. I don't know. There's a lot of support for Game Boy Advance for all the crazy Pokemon hacks and all that too. I don't know, but I'd love to see homebrews on the GameCube, but I don't know if it's even feasibly possible just because the GameCube discs are so unique.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think also there's maybe something about the Dreamcast that it was kind of a bit of an underdog, you know, a system that was never, the full potential didn't feel like it was explored back when it came out.
Absolutely.
And even with the Atari Jaguar, I mean, that's got quite an active homebrew scene, bizarrely, you know, a lot of stuff tends to come out.
Isn't
that
funny? Yeah. Well, and there's a huge homebrew scene for, here in the United States, there's a huge, I mean, it takes up like 8 tables or something, or maybe even more than that. But at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo, all of the great new games that come out every year for the Atari 2600, the ColecoVision, the Intellivision. It's just, it blows my mind. And there's people who just go by every year and they just literally just, they show up and they buy one of each because you never know, you know, it's just, it's fun to see. But I mean, you could say the same thing. Well, there's only a couple of homebrews available for TurboGrafx-16. I know TurboGrafx-16 is a very niche system, just about anywhere in the world, maybe outside of Japan, but it's, I love seeing the creativity. Anytime I hear that there's like a new homebrew for like Jaguar, I'm like, what? Really? That's insane. I love it. And I love to hear it, you know, because those are the people who are doing it for the hobby, not for the money, because they know they're not going to make enough money to, you know, maybe even break even on that versus, you know, doing it for Dreamcast or something else.
Is there anything you'd ever explore, like, you know, porting one of your games to TurboGrafx or the Jaguar, for example?
I mean, if there was a possibility, I looked into it. I asked about TurboGrafx-16 because I have a friend of mine who did. But it involves another source of coding for it or something like that. So, I mean, can it be done? The answer is always yes. But I also don't know. I'd probably make enough to sell 10. You know, and then by that point, you know, I'd be losing money doing that, but at least I would have one.
And so those 10 people would be very grateful to have a new game on their system.
They may be. They certainly may be. There's a market for anything. It just depends on, you know, what that market is. But something like that might be more, you know, funded for the passion, and then, you know, maybe the game actually makes money on Steam more than anything else. Who knows? You know, or maybe even on mobile. You know, it's hard to say one way or another. But that's all that community aspect where it's like, oh, I made this thing, and we also completely understand too that, you know, there's gamers, which is like the wide spectrum, and then a very small sliver of that's like the retro gamers, and then even less of that are the people who are into indies and especially homebrews, where, you know, we also understand too it is a labor of love. It is a baker going out there making the best cake possible, taking 5 years to make this glorious cake, and somebody comes by with their index finger and swipes a bit of frosting on their tongue and says, "Yeah, it's pretty good," and then walks away. You know, so it's like you're doing it because you love it. You're not doing it because you're trying to change the world.
Yeah, absolutely, John. That's a great point. And obviously, you know, you can be very proud of the work you've done and continue to do as well. I mean, anything coming up from you in terms of like new titles and new stuff on the YouTube channel? Anything in the pipeline we should look out for?
Yeah, I'm going to be starting my... I'm shooting for April. I'm shooting for April to do the Kickstarter for the Choo Choo Mimic CIB copies of the NES cart. I'll have a couple of them. Like I said, I have the loose cards because I can make those myself, but I would like to do something with the box, with the manual. I make my own air fresheners. That's kind of a side hobby that I do. That's another thing that's just purely for fun.
Nice.
But, you know, something I can make like a mimic, you know, I can make a treasure chest air freshener that smells like an old cedar chest in a dank cave. You know, that's kind of fun for me too. You know, I have an arcade one. I have one that smells like a 1980s arcade with menthol cigarettes and wood paneling and, you know, a rusty gumball machine. And it smells just like it. I think it does anyway. And other people say the same too. So, looking forward to that for April. I'm almost completely finished. There's one stage that crashes the entire game. But I'm almost completed. I have another, my next homebrew is coming out for the Mega Drive of all consoles. And it's going to be just like a fun kind of stare. It dates back to my church days where I would try to impress the ladies by carrying like as many stacked chairs as I could to prove how strong I was. So it plays a little like that, where I have to put away all the chairs, but the more chairs I can stack to carry to, I walk slower, but then I'll earn more points that way. So that should be coming out later this year. I don't even know what an ETA would be, if that would be a summer thing, maybe even a fall thing at this point. But later in the year, we'll do that one for the Mega Drive. And I just recently, of all things, I just started training to be a professional wrestler. So you might see me in the ring.
Oh, amazing.
Maybe even I'll do my best Big Daddy impersonation there, and, you know, carry the reins for the UK there, I suppose. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, that's more of a pipe dream. That's something that literally just started maybe a couple of weeks ago, where I was like, oh, I can be a wrestler. I can do that. There's a wrestling school nearby, and I know the promoters, and I know a couple of the local wrestler people. It's like, oh, you could totally do that. You could totally do that. So I was like, yeah, that might be kind of fun. Just another, you know, just try to rule the world one random entertainment hobby at a time.
Well, John, it sounds like you're an extremely busy guy. I'm not sure when you find time to sleep. You know, you do so much, but I'm glad that you did. I'm glad the passion burns so strong. So
best of
luck with it all. And thank you so much for taking a bit of your valuable time to come on and be our guest this week. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, my pleasure. And we'll have to do it again sometime. And there's always some great video game conventions in the UK. So If you happen to find me at a UK convention, I am very approachable. I look like myself, but taller.
Fantastic. Nice. Yeah, we'll hook up for a beer. That'd be awesome.
I love it.
Wonderful. Thank you then, John.
All right. Take care, man.